From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The third presidential impeachment trial in American history begins to unfold in the U.S. Senate today. President Donald Trump faces two articles of impeachment, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Both articles are related to his July phone call with the president of Ukraine, in which Trump asked for an investigation into potential 2020 rival Joe Biden.
Today's session is going to focus on the rules for the trial, how it will be conducted. The House managers, or the prosecutors, and members of President Trump's defense team will debate the various proposals. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants a condensed trial, but there have been objections to his plan for 12-hour sessions, some senators saying at their age they can't sit that long. And when it comes to witnesses and evidence, Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer blasts McConnell's plan and says Democrats will offer amendments.
Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here. And what are your thoughts as we come to you on yet another historic day?
Well, it comes after an evening where Senator McConnell made it very clear that he wants to try to contain this as much as possible, that he's not going to replicate the exact rules of the Clinton impeachment trial in 1999. And Democrats are finding themselves fighting to have as much of a trial as possible. So he kind of laid down the law before this even began.
You know, Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, or the ranking member, the chairman, right? He's chairman now. He said today that the focus on the rules for the Clinton trial is kind of irrelevant because this is a different trial and it's a new trial, and McConnell shouldn't be saying we've got to do everything like the Clinton trial.
Well, it's true. I think what McConnell says is usually some kind of justification to maintain partisan power. We always have to start with that basis. So I'm not sure he was genuinely committed to recreating the Clinton trial. I think that was a way to already limit whether there would be witnesses and how long this would go on. The most notable difference is that in 1999, Trent Lott, who was the Republican leader, and Tom Daschle, who was the Democratic leader, at this point were working together behind the scenes to make this as bipartisan and orderly as possible. Today, I doubt that's happening between McConnell and Chuck Schumer.
Well, and when you say, you know, the difference between then and now, a lot of people may not know what we're talking about. In the Clinton era, hadn't almost all of the witnesses already gone before the House impeachment inquiry? In other words, the difference today is that some of the major people in the room when it happened, you know, the phone call, et cetera, were not allowed to testify.
That's right. Back with Bill Clinton, there had been an extensive investigation by an independent prosecutor named Ken Starr. That report had been public. We had lots of testimony. We had lots of documentation. That was all out there. And even though the president opposed the impeachment process, he didn't totally obstruct it. And we've had a much more aggressive approach without the independent prosecutor. So we just have less information.
Can you just take a look back just a little further? We don't want to spend all the time in the past, but you mentioned Ken Starr's investigation, the Ken Starr report. This was when Ken Starr was an independent counsel, and he began by investigating the Clintons' investments while in Arkansas in real estate. It was called the Whitewater scandal. But he couldn't find any charges against the Clintons in that, and then widened his investigation with the okay of Clinton's AG, Janet Reno, into claims the Clintons fired travel agents, the claims of abuse of FBI files. Then there was a lawsuit claim that Clinton sexually harassed a woman named Paula Jones. And then another woman named Linda Tripp contacted Starr, I mean, this is going on over a long period of time, to tell her about an intern named Monica Lewinsky. Bill Clinton lied. He said he didn't have relations with her, and he did. So his impeachment was because he lied. After all of these investigations into other things, nothing stuck. You could say that President Trump kind of avoided that because he never testified.
No, that's true. I mean, in the heart of the Clinton impeachment was an offense that many people acknowledged but didn't think was worthy of impeachment, of removing the president. In this case, the president hasn't been forced to testify, but he said things that don't accord with everything we know. So he's been caught not telling the truth, not in a court of law, not in an official capacity. But in this case, it's not the lie so much as what he actually did. It's the substance of how he used foreign policy that's at issue. And I think that's why many Democrats and some Republicans quietly think it's more serious of an accusation in terms of using presidential power in an aggressive and abusive fashion.
Julian, do the Democrats have any power here to get what they are asking for? They basically want to have, first of all, not 12-hour days in the trial. They want to have witnesses called, and they want to have more documents provided by the White House. Do they have any power at this point to get what they want? Because it does seem, even when you look at some of these moderate Republicans like Mitt Romney and what they're saying, it sounds like they're going to vote along with Mitch McConnell right now.
So far, last night, Romney already made that clear that he's satisfied with what McConnell is doing. They don't have a lot of power. The only power they have right now is public sentiment and public pressure. And if that pressure increases on those Republicans, the Republicans need 51 votes for the rules. And that's the only thing that can really break it. And at this point, it's not looking as if they're changing.
Worth pointing out that it was 100-0 on the rules back in the Clinton impeachment.
Yeah. And could I just ask, is the power that they have maybe Hunter Biden? I mean, if the Democrats were to say, okay, we will give you Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, if you will give us all of these other witnesses.
Well, they could, and I think some Democrats wouldn't love to have Hunter Biden testify. They think it's ridiculous because it has nothing to do with the charge of how the president used his power.
Right.
But they'd be willing to do that in exchange for high-level officials like a John Bolton, who theoretically would be willing to say that the president misused his authority. But again, there's also just the timeline. I mean, both parties have incentives to keep this somewhat constrained. Four senators are looking very anxiously at the clock right now.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is the first time that there has been an impeachment trial in an election year. And the senators you're talking about are the senators who are running for president. What does it mean for the presidential campaign, do you think, that these senators are going to be kept off the trail leading up to the Iowa caucuses, and even the fact that this trial is going on as people are starting to think about who they'll vote for in November?
Well, for the Democrats as a party, I think this is relevant. I think the revelations that have come forward, the polls we keep seeing that upwards of 51% think a sitting president should be removed from office, that's pretty stunning from the perspective of presidential history. That's all going to matter come November 2020. This will be part of what people are judging in terms of, do they want a second Trump term? In terms of the immediate future, though, you know, former Vice President Biden, Pete Buttigieg, they have an open field right now in Iowa. And for someone like Senator Klobuchar, this could be pretty devastating not to be on the ground in the next couple weeks.
I just want you to underscore what you just said, Julian, because when you say 51% of the American public, you know, want to have their sitting president removed, that's pretty incredible comparatively. Is it because people, I mean, would you elaborate on that? Because people would say, well, that means, you know, people might be astonished. There are people who would be astonished that 50% of Americans don't want Donald Trump removed after some of the actions he's taken. But you think that this is historic?
Sure. This is a very high part of the population. And the polls have fluctuated, but they've been between 45% to a majority. And even if many people naturally don't want a president removed, that is the default position for most Americans. What's more striking to me is how many are willing to say, yes, he deserves that. And that says a lot about how people see the character of this president.
The president is in Switzerland today as this trial gets underway. He's in Davos at the World Economic Forum, and he spoke today. Let's listen.
When I spoke at this forum 2 years ago, I told you that we had launched the great American comeback. Today, I'm proud to declare that the United States is in the midst of an economic boom, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
Julian, what does it mean that the president is overseas? Is he trying to show that he's just doing business as usual, not paying attention? And remind us what Clinton did during his trial.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, Clinton did try to show it was business as usual. He was very explicit talking about the fact he would govern while the Senate conducted this trial. I don't know if President Trump going overseas, boasting about the economy will mean we'll see business as usual. I doubt it. I'm sure we're going to see tweets. I'm sure we're going to see statements. The president can't help but undercutting his own message on the economy. So I think it will be a very different kind of trajectory.
Look, Julian, everybody's done the math over and over again. And, you know, many Americans are saying, well, why should I even watch this? Because I know the outcome. I know that the Republicans are going to try to drive it through. The Democrats don't have the votes or the power to do anything to change where this is probably going. Why should we watch? And what are you watching for?
Look, it's not just about the outcome for the president. It's about the substance of what's revealed. So like the hearings in the House, the record matters, and the way in which the president has conducted himself and threats that might exist are serious if they are proven to be true. And I think all Americans should be attuned to this. And I think it's worth watching how the parties react to what is revealed. This says a lot about Senate Republicans, not simply about the president.
Julian Zelizer, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
2020 is shaping up to be a great year for rapper and actress Awkwafina. Okay, she didn't get an Oscar nomination for her role in The Farewell, but she won the Golden Globe for Best Actress for that role. How does that happen? And this week, she debuts a new show on the Comedy Channel. Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. It's based on her own life. Her given name is Nora Lum. Let's back up. Awkwafina had a breakout video in 2012. It extolled her lady part. I'm not sure we can even play any of it. Then she had another breakout year in 2018 with comic roles like Paik Lin, the over-the-top best friend in Crazy Rich Asians, who makes her first appearance bursting from a mansion to greet her friend Rachel, played by Constance Wu.
New York in the house!
Paik Lin!
What a man!
You look amazing.
I know, something's never changed, right?
Now in The Farewell, there are laughs and tears. Awkwafina plays Billy, a Chinese-born girl raised in New York by parents who thought it was the best thing to do for her to bring her to the States. And then they think they're doing the right thing by traveling back to China for a remarkable ruse. The entire extended family will gather for a hastily thrown-together wedding, a guise to gather around Billy's beloved grandmother, Nai Nai, who doesn't know she has cancer and maybe weeks to live. In this scene, back in New York, Billy's father, played by Tai Ma, tells her the plan.
The family thinks it's better not to tell her, so you can't say anything.
I don't understand. She doesn't have a lot of time left. She should know, right?
There's nothing they can do. So everyone decided it's better not to tell her.
And what's remarkable? This all really happened. The Farewell is from writer-director Lulu Wang. It's based on her family. You probably heard her story on This American Life. We spoke with the film's star when it first opened and began by asking if she preferred Awkwafina or Nora.
You can call me either. It's your call.
Or is it just Awk?
Call me that, please.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, because I understand your dad was Chinese-American, your mom Korean, and you're playing a character who's going back to China, you know, after spending years in New York. That must have just resonated for you.
Oh, yeah. A lot of things resonated for me in this movie. I think the biggest one is my relationship with my grandma. I was raised by her. Yeah. My mom, who was South Korean, passed when I was four. I was raised by my paternal grandma, and, you know, she was Chinese. And so when, you know, I first got this script, it resonated in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And for me personally, it was definitely a departure from a lot of my past roles. But a lot of that had to do with actually confronting things, you know, like for maybe the first time in my life, this role caused me to preemptively confront the death of my own grandma, which I've always thought about.
Yeah.
And I think it taught me to be vulnerable in ways that I really haven't been.
What tension for you, because here you are playing a character who's not allowed to share mm-hmm. these feelings of grief with this beautiful Chinese actress who plays your grandmother. And meanwhile, you just told us you're struggling to maybe feel some grief about your real grandmother.
Yeah, exactly. It's stifled a bit. You know, Billy is obviously loosely based on something that actually happened to Lulu. But Lulu was never like, I want her played this way, study me. It was never that. And there is me in there, but it's a role that eventually came to be like a vessel for the Asian American experience. Because a lot of people have to do this. When you see a family in this, your family in this context, you have to make the decision whether to greet them with sadness or to greet them with joy. It always is like a matter of like how different families deal with grief. You know, everyone does it in their own way, but it also for Billy, it is a period of growth for her yeah. because she goes back to learn that her way is not the right way, always.
You said as a child, when your mom first passed, you're the little one and you became a fixture of sorrow, you know, almost a mm-hmm. totem. Family members would come up to you and cry and you didn't like that. And maybe that's part of why you began to turn toward comedy. You wanted some joy. Your yeah. character travels from New York to China, where the entire sensibility about death is we're not
different.
Going to talk about it.
Yep.
We've talked to author Gis Chen about East-West cultural differences. She says Americans place emphasis on the development of the individual. Asians see mm-hmm. themselves in relation to the society. There's almost that exact conversation from the person who plays your uncle in the film.
Yeah, it stems from wanting to literally take a burden that shouldn't belong to someone that you love. Mm-hmm. And it also stems from this concept called filial piety, which is like you never hear of it unless it's in the context of like East Asian culture. And it is just this undying respect for your elders, for your ancestors. It's something that Asian American people have. But along with that, they also have elements of resentment and obviously guilt.
Well, what your uncle says to you is you want, and your character does really very much want to tell your grandmother, shouldn't she know? She should know she doesn't mm-hmm. have much time. And he says that's to make you feel better. We're taking on the burden of knowing so that she doesn't have to know. So we're going to feel worse, but that's the way it goes. And by the way, I should say, this is a very heavy subject, but it's hilarious.
Farcical.
Yeah. What was it like for you there? I mean, because your character speaks of, I don't know who I am, and I, you know, I don't know where I belong, and am I speaking correctly? How about you?
Yeah, my Chinese is not perfect. Like, I did not grow up in a Chinese-speaking household. But at the same time, there is a very personal journey that occurs when you are Asian American in this country and you go back to Asia. You know, you always feel like you are an outsider in America, but when you go there, you really understand how much of an outsider you are. Yet, you have history there and you can't forget that. As an actor, that happened for me. But I think that also, I know what it's like to go and meet someone, a family members that may live in another country that you can't communicate with, but the love is there. And like trying to make them laugh and stuff like that. And I think that's what Billy's trip was trying to convey, the joy that you feel when you see your family. And maybe you can't communicate with them properly, but you still feel the love.
Yeah. I just want to detour for a second because you know, we mentioned, you know, your career prior to this film, including your 2012 viral video.
I just want you to say it at some point.
About your lady part.
Yes.
4.5 million views. One woman throwing down about another, you know, comparing hers with another. Let's just listen to a little. My vag bounced like J-Lo's booty. Your vag like James Lipton's booty. And my vag, it's ornamental. Your vag is a 5-hour PBS special. Yo, my vag. What were you thinking?
Man, you know, there was a song that had a similar title that it was actually a cover of. A parody of, I should say, about male parts.
Right.
And it was a simple question of why don't women have one? And so that's what it was. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know.
Well, I was kind of thinking about your new film. Again, The Farewell, it kind of debunks the myth of the submissive Asian woman because here's this strong grandmother, the matriarch of the family. You said your grandma became the matriarch of yours. strong, somewhat vulgar at times, you know.
yes, she was.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering if doing something like that video was about throwing off some of those expectations of Asian women.
Well, yeah, I think that at that time, not a lot of Asian women presented themselves in that way. Mm. And very quickly after that, I was told various things, like I was very brave, you know, like, wow, you must have a lot of confidence, you know. Mm. But that's the truth. I think that I've always found truth in being shameless. I think that we are taught, you know, actual Asian Americans, the ones who grew up in this country, I think that we all grow up with very strong matriarchs. And I grew up with one. And that stereotype, or that example of like who we actually grew up with, influences us more as people than like who we're fed in or portrayed in the media. And my grandma always nurtured like what other people would label weird. She told me that was the best part. Mm-hmm. And ever since I was like a very young child, so she always believed in me. And I think that, you know, if she didn't see, let me like explore that aspect of my personality, Awkwafina would never have been formed.
Look, you know, maybe doing a role or a video in defiance of an expectation of you. But then I'm wondering, sure, if there's also a burden to get it right.
Of course, yeah. We do, as Asian Americans, owe something back to our community. Not in a way that it's like if we make something great and it blows up in the box office, but morally, right? And I think that if we're given right now in 2019 the platform to tell our stories, let's do so with truth, with authenticity, and also with being uniquely ourselves, because we're not all the same. And we have different stories. We come from different places. And so I think that there is always going to be that responsibility because there's just not that much.
Well, and on the other hand, I just should say that while there's something very specific to the Chinese culture, this idea of throwing a huge wedding just to, you know, say goodbye to grandma without telling her that she has a terminal illness, that may be specific, but I wept.
Oh, there's so much truth. No matter what race you are, what you are, you will connect to this because we all experience loss, yeah, and we all experience love, whether it's a grandma or family, you know, and we know what that's like, and we know what it's like to lose it.
There is an image, and to me, it's one of the saddest images in the world, no matter where it is, the receding image of an elder from the back, mm-hmm, of the car as you drive away.
Oh, it's
killer.
It is a wrecker.
And we're not going to give away the ending, except to say there will be a snapback, what, just before the credits.
There will be. Yes.
Awkwafina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. This was lovely.
The Farewell star, Awkwafina, speaking with us last July. The Farewell is available on DVD and by streaming. Her new Comedy Channel show, Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, debuts tomorrow.
The Veterans Administration has now banned smoking at all of its medical facilities, eliminating the designated smoking areas at hospitals and clinics. The change went into effect for patients and visitors back in October, and as of this month, the ban also extends to employees. For some, it has been a difficult transition. Stephanie Colombini of WUSF reports for the American Homefront Project.
70-year-old Air Force veteran Ronald West sits in his wheelchair just outside the fence that encloses the Tampa VA hospital grounds. It's a cold day for Florida, so he's wearing a sweatshirt, a winter hat, and is wrapped in a blanket. He lights up a Newport cigarette, his second since wheeling himself out of his hospital room for a smoke. West is being treated for a spinal cord injury, and he says he comes out here a few times a day since he's no longer allowed to smoke on the property.
It actually sucks. They had designated smoking areas. That's what the veterans was adhering to. But now, no smoking on the campus? Come on.
West isn't alone on this sidewalk. The hospital fence is lined with smokers, most sporting employee badges and wearing scrubs, plus a few more patients. Army veteran Tom Rogers comes to the VA for his lung disease and other medical needs. He was angry to find out about the smoke-free policy.
We risked our lives in Vietnam over 50 years ago, and they tell him now he can't have a cigarette?
Patients aren't the only ones griping.
The VA announced earlier this year that the ban would also apply to staff. The American Federation of Government Employees filed a grievance, saying it violates a union contract that allows workers to smoke in designated areas. The issue was not everyone was sticking to those areas, according to Dr. Dawn Johnson. She promotes smoking cessation at the Tampa VA.
We had a lot of problems where patients would be walking in to their medical appointments and would have to walk through people smoking.
Replacing smoking areas are signs throughout the campus informing people about the change. Eventually, VA hospitals will enforce the policy with citations and fines. But many, like Tampa's, are taking time to educate first.
Some of our patients only come here once a year, and if they didn't hear about it, we can't hold them responsible for it.
Thousands of other healthcare facilities have already banned smoking, and research shows it improves public health. Still, smoking has long been connected with military culture. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more than a third of veterans started using tobacco after they entered the service, although less than 15% who use the VA smoke now. Veteran Colleen Danielson was already smoking before she joined the Marines in the 80s, but says it was a huge part of her life.
I used it, I thought, as stress management. You know, in the Marines, we got a few extra breaks for, you know, when we smoked. We were outside a little bit more.
Danielson quit cold turkey years ago. Now she's a VA peer support specialist who helps other vets quit. The VA also offers counseling, a helpline, and nicotine replacement products like patches and gum.
This day rules ain't taking care of me. So, you know, I'm following.
Health workers in Tampa say they're not asking every vet to quit smoking. Just do it on the other side of the fence. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
The 2020 census officially kicks off today in Tuksuk Bay, a small fishing village in far western Alaska on the Bering Sea. Census workers are gathering there, equipped with parkas and smartphones, ready to knock on doors and take demographic information tonight. But when the rest of us get canvassed, we can do it online. In fact, this will be the first U.S. census that will be conducted primarily online. And it comes after a month-long attempt by the Trump administration to add a citizenship question to the census, an attempt that failed. Well, also in Tuksuk Bay, waiting eagerly for the first person to take the census is NPR's Hanzi Lawang. Hanzi, remind us, why does the census begin in this remote village?
Well, this is a tradition that goes back to the 1960 census. That's the first one that was conducted in the U.S. after Alaska became a state in 1959. And the reason for that is because the Census Bureau realized that in the remote parts of Alaska, January is the time to go to try to visit households, because that is when the ground is still frozen. And that means there are multiple modes of transportation. You can take dog sleds, snow machine. And also, it's a time when a lot of these communities, which are subsistence communities that rely on seasonal hunting and gathering traditions and maybe moving around to different areas once the weather gets warmer, the winter time, January, that's when folks are still in their communities and it makes it easier to find them and to interview them.
Isn't that fascinating? And this census is going to travel to different remote parts of the U.S. But for instance, the census is not starting today, even in Anchorage. It doesn't start in the rest of the country till mid-March.
Exactly. March 12th is when most households in the country are expected to receive a letter from the U.S. Census Bureau with instructions on how to participate. Some households will get a paper form. Most households will only get instructions to go online or to dial a 1-800 number to participate.
Yeah. And so what are people there telling you about this spotlight that is on them?
It's quite a moment for Tuksuk Bay. I think it's safe to say most of the folks I talked to never dreamed that this would happen. Most folks weren't even really familiar with this idea of being the first community counted or to have someone be selected from their community to be the first person counted. And I talked to the tribal administrator in Tuksuk Bay, tribal minister of the Nunakayuk Traditional Council, which governs the Nunakayuk Amit tribe of Tuksuk Bay, Robert Pitka. And let's listen to what he said.
What's taking place is so important for all the communities throughout Alaska and throughout the nation, because there is so many needs. We need bigger school. Our school is overcrowded. And it's not just in Tuxuk Bay, but I'm sure it's in all villages.
And tribal administrator Robert Pitka, yeah, he told me that he hoped that conducting the census and making sure there's an accurate count will ultimately lead to the community getting a greater share of the more than estimated $1.5 trillion in federal funding a year that gets distributed based on census numbers, the federal funding for healthcare, for roads, for schools, and a lot of other public services.
Well, you know, it is hard to overstate the importance of the census. It determines representation in Congress, as you say, funding. I mean, this is... It's very important.
Exactly. Even though it is a very under-the-radar constitutional mandate required by the Constitution, every 10 years, a count of every person living in the country, it forms how political representation, federal funding are distributed, but also really sets the reality that everyone living in the United States will be living under, because even businesses rely on this information to determine, for example, where to open new supermarkets.
Yeah, well, and as you say, everyone living in the United States, that's the key to the census. And that's why the controversy over whether or not there would be a citizenship question, you know, kind of rocked the Census Bureau so much. People were worried that if people were concerned about their citizenship status, they wouldn't respond. And it isn't about, you know, people who are citizens. It's about people who are living here. So how have they recovered, if that's the right word, from all that controversy?
It was a really major, major controversy. Again, to be very clear, there will not be a citizenship question on the 2020 census forms, because that question has been permanently blocked from the 2020 forms by three federal courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld lower court rulings, in part because it found that the Trump administration's reasoning for why it said it wanted to add this question to supposedly better enforce the Voting Rights Act, that was found by multiple federal judges to be essentially a sham justification. And at this point, the Census Bureau is trying to, it's best to move forward, because its research has shown that this is a particularly sensitive question to groups that have been historically undercounted, and including immigrant communities, Latino communities, and Asian Americans.
Yeah. And this is why you say the census has spent, what, $500 million on an ad campaign directed to those groups.
This is an ad campaign that actually is trying to reach the entire country, but also have some specific focused messages to historically undercounted groups, including communities of color, and trying to encourage people to participate in the census, also to increase awareness about the census. But what I've heard from census advocates, that what actually is the most effective tool to encourage people to become aware and to participate is to hear it from a local community leader, a trusted person. Those are the most effective ways. And the big question is that in this current political climate and a lot of fear about how the census information could be misused by the Trump administration, even though federal law prohibits the Census Bureau from releasing data identifying individuals until 72 years after it's collected, the question is, will people trust that the administration will uphold those laws?
Yeah, that's interesting. They can't release any of this material for 72 years. And yet, as you say, because of the whole controversy over, you know, whether or not the question was going to be added before the courts ruled, some people may still think it's in there. So that word has to get out. Census questionnaires are made available in 13 languages, but back to where you are in Alaska, do they have indigenous languages there, and are they on the form?
The forms are not available in any Alaska Native languages. There's also only one American Indian language, the forms are available, and that's Navajo. And the reason for that is the Census Bureau this time around came up with a very specific standard policy, and they focused on non-English languages spoken in around 60,000 or more households with limited English skills. And that was the cutoff. And because of that, a lot of languages spoken by smaller size populations, including a number of Southeast Asian languages, those have not been included and have raised concerns among census advocates that in the groups that are historically undercounted, that having as many language resources would be the ideal situation. But it is a matter of choice and deciding how to best use the limited resources the Census Bureau has.
Yeah. So Hansi Luong, there you are in Tuxuk Bay. I love saying that. Can you take 1 second? What does it feel like? What are you seeing?
It's a small fishing village. And what you see is a lot of white white snow on the ground, obviously, because it is Alaska in January. Yeah. But also a couple days here have been so cloudy. The sky is also very white. And so you just feel like walking around, you're just enveloped in white. Yeah. And then you see these really brightly colored houses in bright blues and yellows and greens sticking out from the white snow. They're kind of small ranch-style homes. And you have power lines draping overhead. And as you get closer to the beach, which just looks like a snowfield because it's all covered and the bay is frozen over, there are some boats lying around kind of sticking out outside the snow. And it just looks like a really charming seaside town.
Well, sounds wonderful. And I know that you are also anticipating the very first person. Now, are people in this town dreading that, or are they excited about who might be the very first person who is asked questions on the census?
There's a lot of emotions going on. I think this is, again, a small town. Last time in 2010, the Census Bureau counted 590 people living here in Tuksuk Bay. We're not sure how many people will be counted today. And then so they're not used to having so many visitors all at once, including journalists ourselves. We're camping out here at the school in classrooms because there's no hotel. There are no restaurants. This is really just for people who live here. And so the first person to be counted, we visited with her, Lizzie Chemiuk, and she is preparing to receive Census Bureau officials to her home to conduct this count in private because of the privacy restrictions. But it will be a very tight fit if a lot of Census Bureau workers are inside the home ready to gather information.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful thing for Lizzie, but also something that they might dread there. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang from Tuksuk Bay in Alaska. As the first person gets ready to be asked questions for the 2020 census, thank you so much, Hansi.
You're very welcome, Robin.
President Trump is far away from Washington today as the impeachment trial begins in the Senate. He's in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting. Today he gave a speech touting the strong U.S. economy.
Years of economic stagnation have given way to a roaring geyser of opportunity. U.S. stock markets have soared by more than 50% since my election, adding more than $19 trillion to household wealth and boosting 401ks, pensions, and college savings accounts for millions of hardworking families.
Joining us now from Davos is Tom Keen, host of Bloomberg Surveillance. Tom, welcome. It's great to have you back.
Jeremy, wonderful to be with you.
How has President Trump been received there at Davos?
Fascinating and very different than the previous visit. He came here with a little less hoopla. Clearly in the Congress Center, there wasn't the uproar of his celebration after election. And also fascinating, I thought, Jeremy, was the speech. Here, there was a real belief he would in some way turn to a global speech. It sounded like a speech he could give in Charlotte, August of this year.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it sounded like a domestic speech that he would give at the Republican convention, a victory lap of all of his attainments and that. Only late in the speech did he really pay any homage to the global elites here talking about Europe.
One of the other people who's gotten a lot of attention today giving a speech there at Davos is the climate change teen activist Greta Thunberg, who spoke. And she pointed out to world leaders that they're all about to fail in their commitments that they made in the Paris Climate Agreement. But no one seems to care, she says. Here she is.
Any plan or policy of yours that doesn't include radical emission cuts at the source starting today is completely insufficient for meeting the 1.5 or well below 2 degree commitments of the Paris Agreement.
How was that speech received there?
It was received differently than it would have been received a year ago, and it was received with an incredible intensity of listening. This place has been humbled, Jeremy, over the last number of years where climate change and global warming is an issue. It is something to worry about, no question about that. But far more than that, is the new of global warming. It's the key difference at this Davos, and she was listened to most carefully.
And are the business leaders ready to take action in a way that they haven't in the past on climate change? Is that something that they can do?
Well, we'll see about that. McKinsey came out with an important study that was, I think, made a nice splash the other day. Lawrence Fink of BlackRock, of course, has made two splashes in the last 20 days. But to your good point, can it be executed on? And that's a great debate. I'd say the center tendency here is private enterprise is doing the best they can. And the question is, how do they engage government?
Who else is there at Davos this year?
What I noticed this year is there's far less celebrities. There's fewer academics. I was talking to Ken Rogoff of Harvard University today about this. And there was a real shift 6-7 years ago towards less academics, less experts, and much more of a corporatist feel. I can tell you down the promenade, the main avenue here in Davos, it's ever more corporate this year. They're front and center.
So what do they think about what's going on in the global economy right now? President Trump obviously likes to tout the U.S. economy, the stock market, low unemployment here in the U.S. But what are people feeling about how the global economy is doing right now?
It's an interesting picture in that it's not on the radar. The markets are not on the radar, of course, with the great bull market, and we've seen that in the last couple of weeks. But the economy is a feel-good economy for these elites. And as you well know, Jeremy, there's a whole other part of the developed world that's saying, well, we're not participating. One of the big splashes in the last 24 hours has been Richard Edelman's Edelman Trust Barometer, which is completely devoted to your question, which is capitalism is advantaging elites, but so many of the people they polled don't feel like they're part of that economy.
Are they expecting recession? Are people that you're talking to expecting that there'll be a downturn?
No, I don't think so. In fact, while we were on set today, John Farrow and I, John Golub at Credit Suisse raised his price target on the S&P 500. You don't do that if you're expecting a recession.
Hmm. And I'm putting you on the spot, but what's the most interesting thing you've heard this year from somebody you've talked to?
Well, that's a loaded question. I would say the most interesting thing I've seen at Davos, and we're only in the first day, has been how serious climate change has become this year. I can't convey enough the difference, whether it's the Australian fires, the heat wave in Europe last summer. However you want to put it, that has been the big shock. The real shock of Davos is Barry, the piano player at the acclaimed piano bar, moved his venue. So that's been the real news, is the guy at the piano bar moved.
Tom Keen, who is the host of Bloomberg Surveillance, joining us from Davos, Switzerland. Tom, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here Now.